You know, we have a lot of great habitats in the state of Wisconsin. They range from wetlands to prairies, maybe forests and savannas. So I guess it's no wonder that we have a really rich diversity of wildlife here in Wisconsin. And whether you've lived here a few months or your whole life, I'm betting you've come to appreciate how much our wildlife and natural areas add to our life here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here, really great, fortunate to have with us today wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He comes by regularly to share what he's been seeing and to help you and I understand what's going on out there. And Scott, welcome back.
Well, Larry, Happy New Year. Happy New Year. I'll tell you what, it's nice to be out of the house, it's nice to be out of the hospital, and it's nice to be back here.
It's been October, I think, was the last time, and you've had surgeries.
I started to feel poorly back in midsummer, and it just took a long time and a lot of tests and assorted other things to figure out what was the root cause of all the different difficulties. That turned out to be my heart yet again, and that led to rather extended surgery on December 3rd, and I've been either lying around the hospital or at home now for the last four or five weeks. So despite the cold and the Arctic vortex, it is very nice to get out of the house, and I'm certainly not back to 100%, but my voice has come back, and I had lost my voice last fall, so that was part of the reason I was off the air for a long time. So it has been a while, but it's really nice to be back. It was just great to, over that period, hear from listeners. I got cards, emails, and whatnot, and just said, hey, we kind of miss you on the radio, hope you're doing well, and all those well wishes from listeners, from family and friends. It turns out that kind of stuff is very important. And anybody who's been through an extended illness or surgery or whatnot, I think, understands that very clearly. So that part of it's been great. But it is good to be on, and this time of year, and with the extreme cold and the hunting season's winding down and a lot of other things, there are lots of things to talk about.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, this time of the year, I think it's worth it to do a little review about our wildlife resources, kind of the status of things here in the state. And I know you've probably in the last month been thinking about that a little bit as you looked outside at the at the landscape.
I've had lots of time to think about lots of stuff, Larry. Yeah, so yes, that's certainly true. And actually, it has been a good time for me to be down, so to speak, because it's been so cold, you really can't do much outside. But we've got, you know, we live in the countryside, and I've been able to sit there looking out over the prairie, and saw lots of deer right in the backyard this year that I'd never seen before, just because I wasn't usually home to see them during the daylight. And there's been lots of things going on. The birds have been very active at the feeding stations, so you again begin to realize just how important those bird feeding stations can be to people who are shut in or by choice or by circumstance. So all that was great. But there were a couple, you're right, there were a couple of things I wanted to do. One was to just talk a little bit about the resource base, bring people back up to speed on that. And then the other was to look back at a couple of summaries that have come out in the last few days, one from the Wildlife Society at the national level, one from the DNR at the state level, on kind of what were the wildlife or natural resources highlights of 2013. So by way of the resource first, I would just repeat, as we've done many times over the year in the program, that, as you said, we are very lucky here in Wisconsin to be essentially positioned at the intersection of a number of major community or plant habitat types in North America, from the northern forests to the eastern deciduous forests, the Great Plains, prairie, and so forth. So we do have a wonderful diversity of wildlife that totals just over 500 species of birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians, comprised of just a few over 400 birds, and the ones over 400 are rare or unusual sightings of individual birds, 65 or 70 mammals, depending on what you choose to include, and about 55 or so reptiles and amphibians, again, totaling just over 500 animals. So there's lots out there. Well, there's lots out there to see. Now, obviously, some of the big hairy stuff seems to garner most of the public's attention, the deer and the wolves and the bears and so forth. However, when you start to factor in the frogs and salamanders and snakes and small mammals and all the little songbirds that look pretty much the same to many people, there are lots of things out there that you can kind of get interested in and study very easily. It's not that easy for somebody to go out and find a wolf or a bear to look at, but if you get interested in some of these songbirds or the small mammals that are invading your garage right now to try and stay alive in the Arctic vortex, then you can find some pretty neat stuff to study literally right under your nose. So we are lucky with the species diversity, and we're lucky that for a lot of those species, they are very abundant and their populations are doing very well. And in part because of, I think, public support and interest and financial resources and the capabilities of our resource management agencies and professionals, a lot of the species that we might have been pretty worried about two or three or four decades ago when we were first doing radio programs back in the 70s and early 80s, those species are doing very, very
well.
And we'll talk in a few minutes. I mean, bald eagles are at record numbers in the state. Next weekend, the Golden Eagle survey is coming up.
Yeah,
and
that's
a few
cool.
years ago, we didn't even think there were any golden eagles here, and neither did the field guides. And, of course, the Endangered Species Act just turned 40 back, I think, on December 28th, and there have been lots of successes. There's been some problems with it, to be sure,
right.
but there have been lots of successes such that wolves are now off the endangered species list and have become commonplace enough in Wisconsin to sustain a hunting season, which is another long story. But overall, many of our wildlife populations are doing very, very well. And we actually, with some animals, deer in some places, Canada geese in other places, and a few other species, have problems of overabundance rather than scarcity. So there are still many issues that need some attention and many things for the resource managers to direct their attention to, but overall,
pretty good.
Things look pretty good.
Yeah,
and we're in a good place. We have excellent diversity. We have excellent public support and interest. Wildlife is recognized as an important component of our quality of life here in Wisconsin, for recreational and aesthetic purposes and personal reasons for everybody. So, it's a good deal. So what? What went on over the past year? You want to cover a little bit of that now, Larry, or should we take a couple of questions? What's your pleasure?
Let's take a question.
You're the boss. You're the boss here, Larry.
Let's take – Nancy has been waiting so long.
All right.
I want to give her a chance to join us, and she has an interesting question, too. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Good to have Scott back. My question, don't laugh, Scott, is whether it's possible that I could have seen a wolverine running across the highway. It's just a little bit south of Copper Falls, where I was coming back down from camping. And I had seen this wonderful documentary on wolverines on public television, and I saw that it seemed to me that a wolverine running has this kind of galloping gait. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And I saw this animal tear across the highway, and it was strong and fast, and it had that gait. And I said, gosh, was that a wolverine? So what do you think? It was where the highway goes through the Shawamigan Forest.
And the animal was very dark in color?
Yes, very dark, had a good tail on him. He had a head that in profile was kind of bear-like shape, but not a, you know, didn't have a bear tail.
Yeah.
He had
a
longer tail, you know. And
well, I mean, Larry and I learned a long time ago that we never laugh at anything,
no.
you know, in terms of sightings, because strange stuff turns up all the time. And over the many years of doing this, there have actually been at least two wolverine sightings that I can remember that turned out to be true.
Mm-hmm.
But in both cases, they were escaped animals from confinement animal parks or whatever. Wild wolverines, no. But, you know, up there, a dark kind of hunchback animal with that weasel family gait crossing the road, I wouldn't bet the farm on it, but I'm pretty sure you saw a fisher.
I'd bet almost anything on that. There's a
but
lot
not
of
the farm.
No.
Anyway, I think, Nancy, that what you saw was a fisher.
Okay.
The odds are just many, many, many times more favorable for that than a wolverine. I'm just not aware of any valid sightings of what would be considered an out-of-range or wild wolverine in Wisconsin for many, many, many years. So fishers, on the other hand, similar gait, fun to see, neat animal, and far more likely than the wolverine.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, there you go, Nancy.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Tom in Janesville, let's go to you. Hi, Tom.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Listen, some 20 or more years ago, one of my coon hounds treed a European stone martin over near the Rock Walworth County line.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the wildlife managers down here in both counties about it, and they said there was a population of them that were thriving fairly well in the Kettle Moraine. And since then, my hunting partners and I have seen them, not frequently, but as far west as Big Woods, just a mile east of Janesville.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, since those martins, which look just like our pine martins, except they're gray, seem to be holding their own down here pretty well, and since our pine martins are having a tough time taking off up in the Chequamegon, might they do better farther south?
You mean, might we redirect our attention with the pine martin further south because the stone martin is doing well here? Well, probably not, Tom. I mean, first of all, you're right about the stone martins. They developed a stronghold in the Kettle Moraine years ago, and they have been doing fairly well, and they may, as you suggest, be extending their range from there. But I'm not that familiar with their habitat requirements, but the pine martin in the North Woods is truly a North Woods animal. Now, some of these things that we deal with amongst all those species I mentioned a minute ago are very flexible in terms of their habitat requirements, food habits, and so forth. And a raccoon, for example, can do just as well on the Illinois line as it does up in the suburbs of Duluth.
Yeah.
But for some species that are tied into certain habitat types and conifer forests and feeding on red squirrels and things like that, they're just not going to do well in other areas. So I think as far as the pine martin's concerned, the current efforts that are going underway to bolster their population where they have not thrived like the fisher did when they were reintroduced probably have to stay in place. But interesting idea, though.
Yeah.
And the stone martin, for whatever reason, seems to be doing pretty well, and
more
power to them.
Yeah.
I don't think they've caused any particular problems, and I'm not sure there's much we could do about it even if they were. But nevertheless, bringing the pine martins down here probably isn't in the cards.
Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today here in Wisconsin, Larry Mueller here, my guest Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He's been with the University of Wisconsin for those many years, and great to have him back after an illness that took him out of commission for a little while. So it's nice to have him with us. Certainly you can join in if you have a question. Maybe you got a nice wildlife photo. Go to put that up on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And Scott, I wanted to, before we go back to the phones, John, we'll get to you in just a minute. But I wanted to go back to some of the big events that occurred over this last year. You've got some that, a list of your own.
A couple. I probably could have come up with my own list, but there were a couple of cases here where the Wildlife Society, my professional organization, came up with what they felt were the national top 10 news items as far as wildlife, and then the DNR came out with their list as well. On the Wildlife Society list, I thought there were five or six worth mentioning. One that garnered a lot of attention around the country was the big python roundup in Florida, trying to deal with Burmese pythons slithering all over South Florida. That was a big newsmaker. The the spate of sea lion deaths out in California attracted a lot of national attention when that happened. The continuing declines that are documented all over the world in amphibian populations was pretty newsworthy in 2013. I mentioned the Endangered Species Act turning 40 back in December, and tweaking of the ESA and kind of wrangling over which way we should go with that was a big item. There was a lot of talk about effects of the government shutdown and sequestration on parks and wildlife. Fortunately, yeah, that ended in a more or less timely fashion. And then another interesting item that they felt was really important was the authorization of the shooting of barred owls. This was in British Columbia, but it could be done elsewhere as well, to protect the spotted owls, which, of course, have been kind of a poster child for endangered species management for years. And apparently the more aggressive barred owls are just squeezing out the spotted owls. And although there have been attempts to do that elsewhere, the public has proven not very tolerant of killing or removing one animal to benefit another, even if the one being benefited is in deep trouble. So the fact that that seems to be moving forward, they felt, was quite newsworthy. Now, the DNR's list, there are a couple of things here. Starting back in January of 2013, folks were pretty excited that the 2012 deer hunt was way up from, well, way up. It was up from 2011, where people were unhappy, and the deer harvest was actually pretty darn good. And a record buck archery harvest was set. Things were looking good. Now, of course, a little later in the program, we'll talk about the fact that we ratcheted the wrong way with this past season in the fall of 2013, but that was big news at that point. In March, there was a bit of a press campaign over the fact that state parks were open to hunting, turkey hunting in the spring and deer hunting in the fall. And we'll also talk later about public hearings coming up over the next 2 weeks to make those rules about state park hunting permanent. People may be interested in that. Excuse me. In April, a good friend of mine and a very competent biologist, Dave McFarland, was named the new DNR carnivore specialist. Yeah. That is a very important and contentious position in Wisconsin.
Dave's a good guy.
He's a very good guy. We're lucky to have him in that position. I thought it was of some interest that over 1,000 students participated in the archery in the schools tournament back in April of 2013. That program has just grown by leaps and bounds as an expression of, well, I guess it has something to do with some movies that have come out that have popularized archery. But in reality, I think that that bodes well for the future of outdoor participation by youth and probably bow hunting, a lot of other things. Moving along into the early summer, it was another tremendous year on Lake Michigan for the salmon harvest, and that seems to continue on and on, which is great news. Big news item in June was that a Kirtland's warbler, and we've heard about these little birds that frequent the jack pine forest. Well, not frequent. They're quite rare.
Yeah.
But in fact, a Kirtland's warbler that hatched in Wisconsin and was banded in Wisconsin, returned to its birthplace in Adams County, which was a significant milestone in boosting the populations of that federally endangered bird. So that was kind of a big deal. In July, the information was in on the status of our elk herd up around Clam Lake, and they really had a very good calving season last year. In August, a bunch of new Wisconsin communities were recognized as bird cities. And that program, for people who are interested in it, is a commitment to working with residents of these communities to make their neighborhoods a better place for people, birds, and other wildlife. And that's spreading like wildfire around the state, which is great. Plans were announced in August to bolster the pheasant stocking program, which for pheasant hunters came as terrific news. And from what I heard, I missed the entire hunting season because of the illness, but from what I heard from my colleagues, there were lots of pheasants out there on the public hunting grounds. So that was great. Big news in October, after years of, I think, thinking this was the wrong way to go. In fact, it was a reversal, and rifles were okayed for deer hunting statewide, and that just hasn't proven to be the catastrophe that some people feared. So that's good news. I thought one of the best things that happened in November, the DNR hired 18 new wildlife biologists. Yeah. The first class of new wildlife biologists and a large class that we've had for a long time. So having a lot of vacant positions finally filled is going to be good for the wildlife resource in the long run. And then later in November, of course, the deer season opened, and it was mighty cold.
Yes, it was.
That the cold and the wind played into the diminished deer harvest, and we can talk about that a little later. And the last thing I wanted to mention is I've been online a couple times using it. The DNR released just a couple weeks ago their new Atlas of Public Access Lands of Wisconsin. You can buy the book online through the DNR, or you can access the book and then print the pages that are, for example, around your cabin or around your home or where you hunt or where you hike or whatever. And they're very detailed. They're very nicely done. And they tell you exactly where all of the land that you and I as citizens have access to are available. It's a pretty cool
really
resource.
Cool. They make an app out of that. That would be great if they could have an app for phones and for iPads and that sort of thing.
We'll be off the air in an hour or so. You can work on that this afternoon, Larry.
Scott Graven, our guest. Thanks a lot for listening in today. John in Appleton, you have a question for Scott. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I live just north of Appleton, and I have three birds, a chickadee, a male red-bellied woodpecker, and a female cardinal that are mostly white. The chickadee and the red-bellied woodpecker, especially the female cardinal, is white really just from the head up. The chickadee and the male red-bellied woodpecker have been coming for at least 2 years, and the cardinal now just this past fall. And my question, I guess, I don't know if this is called leucocytic or piebald or how you term it, but is this an environmental product? How does this occur? And is it, I would think these birds would be at a disadvantage being a different color, but they're thriving. They've been here, and the chickadee is kind of the bully of the sunflower seed.
Well, that's an interesting one, John. I mean, we hear lots of accounts over time of individual birds of a variety of species with various degrees of white plumage, ranging from true albinos to leucistic, as you mentioned, or essentially what amounts to piebald. And in some cases, there are other circumstances where birds have feather damage, either due to mites or parasites or physical damage from another bird, where the feathers may grow back in white. So there are a couple different explanations. What's really unusual about your case is that you've got three different species
right.
at the same feeding station, which is very unusual. So I'm not sure what to tell you about that, except it's first and foremost a very unusual confluence of probably what are different circumstances so that you have what you have there at your feeder, because there are genetics issues and so forth that would not be crossing species barriers like that in terms of, breeding or hybrids or anything else. That's not the possibility. So what combination you have in those three birds of the various explanations we just talked about for white plumage, I don't know, but it's really strange. And if you do you ever see them together on the feeders at the same time?
I've seen the white chickadee and the female cardinal together at the same time. I've taken some pictures I thought I could send in.
Well, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
So there are probably some folks more skilled than I in terms of genetics issues and other kinds of things who would enjoy seeing those and may be able to come up with explanations for the individual birds. But as I say, the explanation for one is not necessarily going to carry over to the other one. So it may just be a really weird coming together of the forces, so to speak.
John, if you can post one of those on my Facebook page, that would be wonderful. If you have it,
okay.
If you have the ability to do that, we'll share it with our audience. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post that photo there, and we'll Well, I'll get a look at it. That'll be cool.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Joe. I mean, that's not a very satisfying answer because it's just a case where it's almost like three separate calls about individual birds that we handle as individuals, and here you've got them all in one spot. So pretty strange, pretty cool.
Thanks, John. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Annie in Woodstock, Illinois. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question for Scott about the unfortunate situation of hitting a deer on the road. I've never been involved in that before, but I often think about that when I pass them laying alongside the road. Can he give us some kind of advice or guidelines? Obviously, if they wander off into the field or woods, nothing you can do. But would there be a situation where they might end up laying in the roadway, and what should be done?
Wow, interesting and kind of the tip of the iceberg type question, Annie. Is deer vehicle collisions are a huge issue.
Yep.
In terms of humans who are killed and injured in a state like Wisconsin, hundreds of injuries a year and some deaths, particularly motorcycle collisions, tens of thousands of deer killed outright, maimed to crawl off or, as you say, wander off into the woods with broken legs or whatever. It's just a bad situation and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage to vehicles. So it's a huge problem. There have been lots of things tried in terms of highway crossings, signage, all sorts of technology, and a whole host of other things. None have proved completely satisfactory in ending the problem. So, yes, it does happen. In terms of avoiding the problem, there's no substitute for defensive driving and being cautious when you're in a situation where, in terms of the habitat or the time of day or the time of year, the situation occurs most frequently, like during the rut and the fall.
Right.
But even if you're extremely cautious and know what you're doing, and I have hit a deer at highway speeds, it's a bad situation all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
If you do hit a deer, I mean, you have to do what you can to take care of yourself. You have to take care of your vehicle. And the deer that may be lying in the road, I mean, certainly if you've stopped and it's safe to do so, probably a good idea to move the carcass to the side of the road so it doesn't cause further problems. But you can also run into the problem where the deer is not dead.
Yeah.
That poses another whole set of problems. And in that case, you really need to get on the phone. Fortunately, most people are lugging cell phones around now, so you can reach the sheriff's department much more quickly than in the past, where you'd have to leave the scene to call somebody. So call the sheriff.
That's what you would recommend is call the sheriff's department.
Yes, generally they're the ones that respond, but it gets to the point at times of year in the rut where they just can't keep up with the number of deer being hit. But generally they will come out, and there's an opportunity, for example, if a deer is hit, not damaged badly. Some people are interested in salvaging the carcass. And they can be, in Wisconsin, it's got red tag. They get a confiscation tag. By Wisconsin law, you can take the deer if you hit it, if you want it. Otherwise, they're sometimes collected and literally sold on the open market to people having a game feed or something at a sportsman's club. Or in other cases, they just are left in the ditch, ultimately marked with spray paint for the individual county contractors to come out and pick them up, and eventually they go to a landfill. So there's a lot involved here, but the best advice is to try and avoid the collision in the first place. And if it does happen, then make sure you're safe, that you're off the road. If the car is disabled, you've got to call for help and let the sheriff get involved. And if the deer's still alive, it would be up to law enforcement to dispatch it. Technically, you get into some gray areas with wildlife violations if your solution, the deer's suffering, so I better, bop it over the head or shoot it or something else. That can pose a whole other set of problems. So there's a lot to think about, but you certainly touched on an interesting topic.
I was thinking, thank you so much for calling, Annie. I was thinking about the story and the recording of the fellow calling in who had hit a deer, put the deer in the back, and then the deer wasn't dead, wakes up and starts pounding around in his car while he's going down the road.
Yeah, that's happened more than once, Larry. So, I mean, that's not a particularly good idea either.
No.
So there's lots to think about there, and it's a stressful situation.
Oh,
I
mean,
if you've just hit a deer, there can be a lot of damage to your car. Yeah. You can be hurt.
Yeah.
You just have to be very cautious and hope that doesn't happen to you.
Bill in Elm Grove, Wisconsin, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi there. Listen, this is deer-related. I wonder why there's so many deer in southern Wisconsin. Actually, it's a nationwide problem. But here's a theory. I grew up here in southern Wisconsin, did a lot of hunting, never saw a deer in Milwaukee or Racine County. Traveled to Eastern Europe, Poland, East Germany, Hungary, before the Iron Curtain came down. Never saw a wild rabbit or a squirrel or anything, and I think the people were harvesting them to eat. So my theory is, back in the Great Depression, when times were really tough, and World War II, when meat was rationed, I wonder if people were killing deer for meat outside of the official deer hunting season, and that kept the numbers down. And
I'm sure there were people doing that, but there just weren't many deer in the southern part of the state to begin with at that time in our history. And that was largely due to habitat considerations as much as anything. And once deer began to move in, largely on their own, from what was the stronghold in northern or central Wisconsin, as southern Wisconsin became dominated by mixed agriculture and parks and residential areas and so forth, the deer quickly figured out that, holy moly, this is a really good place to be. And deer are surprisingly prolific for a large animal, and it didn't take too many decades before the population in southern Wisconsin grew on site, so to speak, and became very, very abundant, and still is. Chronic wasting disease and the deer hunting season notwithstanding, there are still a lot of deer. And as you move east in the United States, there are many areas, particularly in urban suburban sites, where there are what the public views as way too many deer, and there are all sorts of efforts underway to come up with new plans and proposals to deal with that, but it is a tough problem.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thanks, Bell, for calling. And Joanne and Lactoflambeau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, I have a question about rose-breasted nuthatches.
Okay.
We always had some at our feeders, and lately we haven't had any. Are they on the decline, or what do you know about that, Scott?
Well, let's deal with the terminology first. There's a rose-breasted grosbeak and there's a red-breasted nuthatch. Are we talking about the nuthatch or the grosbeak?
Nuthatch.
Okay. All right. So, you know, at least at my own feeding stations, the white-breasted nuthatches have always outnumbered the red-breasted. Red-breasted a little more of a forested bird. But
yeah.
Generally speaking, from what I see of the bird reports and the Christmas bird counts from a couple of weeks ago, bird populations and numbers, especially of some of the big northern feeder birds in the North Country, where you are at LDF, are down. And birds like siskins, red poles, crossbills, some of the grosbeaks and so forth have been very scarce. So it's not been a good feeder year, and that's been compounded by the brutal weather over the last couple of weeks. I've not heard of anything particular affecting red-breasted nuthatches. They're not that abundant. They're not a dominant bird at most feeding stations anyway. You get a couple of them. So I'm not sure how to answer the question, except it's not uncommon for some things to come and go at a given feeding station, and mm-hmm. with enough patience or a different season, they'll be right back there again.
Yep, you can hope. Thanks, Joanne, for calling. And Brian in Fond du Lac, hello to you.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Great, thanks. This is one of my favorite shows. I've always enjoyed this, and thank you so much. Appreciate Scott and Larry. 11 or 12 years ago, I had a unique experience with some young guys that I knew who had been ice fishing on Lake Puckaway in Green Lake County, and got a 36 consecutive photographs of a wolverine that was on Lake Puckaway.
That was one of them. Yep, I remember the pictures in the paper of the ice fishermen.
Oh, yeah. That was interesting. Now, you thought that might have been a captive release?
Yeah, I think when that was ultimately investigated by the wardens and so forth, they determined that that had been, I don't think it was a release, I think it was an escape from someone who had the animal in captivity nearby.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I was kind of shocked to be able to see that thing 600 miles out of its normal range.
Yeah,
right.
I had a second comment, too, related to a couple of the questions. Yeah, here's the next one, was the concept of what happens in standing water, running water, groundwater, with this whole new generation that we have of artificial hormones and so on, and what they might be doing to amphibians. Is there a lot of research on that? For instance, you know, as a matter of fact, if you take a, say, a butter dish, put the plastic into a microwave, you can release toxic hormones that are, you know, of the hormone chain, but, you know, they're not natural. I wonder how that affects the biomes.
Well, there are a lot of people concerned about various pharmaceuticals of all kinds, growth hormones, assorted other things, finding their way into the essentially the garbage stream, flush down toilets, down the drain, whatever, that find their way into the water table, as you describe. And there are some very serious effects that have already been documented, and there are a lot of people working on documenting what else is going on. So, yes, this is a big problem, and if people don't properly dispose of things like that, then it's going to get worse.
Yeah. Yep.
Where would one go to see the research on that? I know I read the Journal of Wildlife Management quite a bit.
I tend to see those kinds of things in investigative reporting and editorials in magazines like Audubon or National Wildlife or places like that that are trying to keep tabs on that. So I would Google some of those magazines and try and look back through the indices and see what you can find, or just do a little Google search of pharmaceutical contamination and those kinds of keywords and see what you come up with.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you for calling, Brian. Appreciate it.
Question I had. Hello?
Yes. Yeah. What was
the last question I had was, in the Journal of Wildlife Management, I've read quite a few studies that have happened on feral cat control. this is a tremendously difficult problem to deal with for a number of reasons. But one of the things I've seen on feral cat control has been live capture, sterilization, and release. I go with two out of the three. Why the release?
The so-called TNR, or trap, neuter, and release programs have become popular in some areas, and I think the sense is that, well, here's a chance, you know, we can neuter the cat, we can essentially render it out of the reproductive population, but hey, the cat gets to go back into the wild and do its thing. That is a very contentious issue. I tend to side with you, Brian. Personally, if I've got my hands on the cat that's formerly been out there in the wild consuming whatever that I'd rather didn't consume, having it in hand and neutering it and so forth, I would much prefer to see some sort of reserves or areas or confined spaces or whatever set aside where we just write them off as wildlife habitat or whatever mm-hmm. you want, but concentrate the cats in an area where, you know, sure, they deserve a happy end to their life and so forth, and I understand why people want them treated humanely and sensibly and so forth, but I would certainly rather not sterilized or otherwise see them released back into the wild where they will continue to eat and hunt and do the things we'd rather they didn't do. So you're right in that regard, but you're also right that this is an unbelievably contentious and emotional issue, and I hope it doesn't come up again anytime soon.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Brian. And we'll take some more calls. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, as we talk with him about the world of wildlife here in the state. It's a varied and rich place for our wildlife. And it's fun to talk about it, too. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And let's see, we've got Don in Warren, Illinois up next. Don, hello, thank you for calling.
Good morning. 70 years ago, there wasn't anything that walked, crawled, or flew, or swam that was safe for my buddy and I. And now it's payback, darling. we have six remnants, little pieces of ground we have replanted in prairie. But walking through the cultivated fields, it's basically sterile. There are no field mice, and these are the feed for so many of our much of our game up the scale. What can I do? What can I plant to encourage more mice, therefore feed the owls and the hawks and, you know, field mice and moles get eaten by many things and on up the food chain. How can I improve this?
Hmm. Well, Don, if you've got access to some land, it sounds like you have a couple of small parcels or parcels, I don't know of what size, that you've been restoring prairie to. And, I mean, that's a good first step on my own property.
Yeah.
I've got 10 acres of prairie grass, and I made the decision when I was restoring that from cornfield to not just go with all prairie grass. I got permission from NRCS to put in a 40 or 50-foot wide band of trees and wildlife shrubs along the western 1,000-foot boundary, and that's been growing now for 14 years, and that proved to be incredibly beneficial. It's become, as I thought it would, a wildlife corridor from woods to the south to a big farm to the north, and the travel pathways through there for deer and turkeys and a whole host of other things have just been incredible. And once you get the brush in there and start to get some brush piles that I've made from trimming and downed wood and so forth, all of a sudden the fact that you plant some things and plant succession does its thing, and trees are knocked down by storms, and you end up with some logs on the ground, then all of a sudden you have the kind of habitat back that will support a diversity of shrews and mice and voles and assorted other things, which in turn provide food for foxes and raccoons and possums and assorted other things. So you're on the right track. The difficulty, of course, is that woody vegetation does grow fairly slowly, and people tend to be an impatient group by nature. So you have to be ready to wait a decade or longer before some of these things bear fruit. But prairie, as you're starting out, you know, it's usually about 3 years before you can do a burn or the mowing that actually begins to show your prairie vegetation. But then at that point, things happen very quickly in the prairie grass. But if you're an island in the middle of a sea of intensive agriculture, that poses its own set of problems.
Yeah.
So in that case, the next best thing to do is start working with neighbors. And, you know, they see, hey, that prairie grass is kind of pretty in the fall. I'd like to plant a little of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, although I only have the 12 acres, the one neighbor looked around and said, wow, this is pretty cool. I know I'm tired of getting out of farming. They put in 40 acres of prairie. And then all of a sudden, the other neighbors started asking questions about how do I plant some of that? And pretty soon, you impact enough area that things begin to work out the way you want to see them. So keep up the good work, and it takes some time, but it's just a matter of getting the habitat back on the landscape.
And thanks a lot for calling, Don. Appreciate it very much. And JC in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I wondered if you're speaker there have heard about the confirmed cougar, i.e. mountain lion attack on a human being in Bayfield County in November. Have you heard about that?
Well, I've seen, you know, a number of other accounts of cougars on trail cameras and so forth, but in terms of an attack, no. Larry, you heard anything about that? And you hunt
this
up that way. What was the story?
This individual was jogging in Herbster, Wisconsin, if you know that right in between Fort Wayne and Cornucopia.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, an animal jumped on his back and blindsided him, and it raked his face, his back, and his chest and took him down until he threw it off. He did contact the county sheriff's department, did transport him to the hospital, I believe in Duluth or Ashland, if I'm not mistaken. And he had to take a series of rabies tests, and they did a DNA. He had managed to take some hair follicles from the creature because he didn't know what it was, and it was determined to be a mountain lion.
Hmm.
You hadn't heard about that?
No. When was that, JC?
It was right before deer hunting season, I believe, in early November, and it certainly did happen. It's not a made-up story because he did have to go through a series of rabies tests, which was extremely painful, as you would imagine.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not questioning the account. I'm just surprised. That's the kind of thing that usually is. I've got a couple issues of outdoor news here because of the deer kill statistics, and one of them, where is it? I think it's this one. You know, here's a case. Front page news, half the front page, Washington County man survives attack by black bear. I just got to think that some sort of a documented attack by a cougar. I mean, just any kind of cougar sighting attracts news. But an attack on a person should have been front page news in some of these outdoor publications. So I'm a little baffled, but I hadn't heard a thing about it.
We'll
do a little check-in, and thanks for bringing it up.
We'll bring it up, and we'll do some checking and talk about it next month. You know, you're back next month, and we'll do it again. And there have been, frankly, I mean, in California, for example, and other states, there have been cougar attacks, but not.
Oh, yeah. Vancouver Island is a known hotbed for that kind of thing, and there have been California fatalities. I remember that ugly case a few years ago. I think it was a woman jogger who was killed. And, of course, California is California. Yeah. But as I recall, the storyline was they ultimately killed the cougar. The cougar had a couple of kittens. And I think the way it went, there were more donations and public support for caring for the two cougar kittens than for the women's two orphan children, which was really weird.
Yeah.
But, again, it's California. So, anyhow, we'll have to check into that. I would have expected that to really attract some publicity. But anyway,
we'll look into it. Mike in Winchester, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Hey, I got, since the 6th or 15th of December, I've had a group of bluebirds here, and they're still here. They made it through the heavy cold spell and stuff. I've been feeding them mealworm and stuff like that, but I just wondered if there's anything else I could feed them, and is it a rare occurrence that they have bluebirds this time of year? We have bluebird boxes out here, and we get bluebirds all summer long, but I've never seen them like this in a winter like this. But
how many do you have, Mike?
We had seven.
Okay.
And they're down to five.
Okay.
Well, you know, it is unusual. Most bluebirds, most robins, most songbirds that typically migrate do just that and get the heck out of here. But occasionally some will remain for reasons that are known only to them. I've seen bluebirds in the Arboretum. I think one year it was January 23rd or 24th, and it is a strange, in the dead of winter and cold weather, to see a bluebird sitting in a tree is pretty weird. But it does happen, and there's been even more interest the last couple of weeks in what the heck are the robins doing around here.
Yeah.
And we pulled in, I don't remember what, my wife was picking up something at the dry cleaners, I guess, and dry cleaners are surrounded by some ornamental crabapple, small trees. And there must have been between 50 and 100 robins in there just gorging on the now frozen and squishy crabapples. And as it turns out, robins, and apparently I'm told that it's often males, if they find an area, and there are parts of the state like the Springs area and the Arboretum here in Madison, La Crosse often has reports of this, where robins in decent-sized flocks will remain all winter. And as long as they've got food and open water, they seem able to tough out the cold. Why your bluebirds are here, it's the same kind of situation, but if you're providing them with enough food to get them through this and the weather moderates like it's supposed to here shortly, you know, you went from 7 to 5, you may drop down to 2 or 3, but if you get a couple of them through the winter, then so be it.
Mm-hmm.
But why they chose to stay when the other 99.9% of the bluebirds decided it was time to get the heck out of here, I can't tell you.
Probably regretting it now.
Probably regretting the decision.
Thanks a lot for calling, Mike. And, you know, really, take deer and all the animals out there that are not hibernating, and you got 25 below or 30 below. People are wondering, how the heck do they live?
Yeah, and we talk about that, you know, sitting looking out the windows, and it's a sterile landscape. Well, where the heck are the deer? What are they doing? And for the most part, these animals that are evolved to stay here in Wisconsin, that, as you say, don't hibernate, don't migrate, the ones that remain are adapted to get through this stuff, for the most part. Now, winter in terms of the cold and snow and ice, is the bottleneck for every wildlife population here in Wisconsin. That's when the population is necked down to its lowest seasonal level just prior to the breeding season the following spring. And last year we saw it with that miserable, cold, snowy, icy April and whatnot that really took a toll on a number of things. It knocked out the wild pheasants around my place. It hit the deer herd hard in the north woods again. This stuff does happen, but enough of the animals remain and survive that the populations eventually rebuild. But for those animals that are not as well adapted as others, think about a possum, for example. In this brutal cold, they are just hunkered down somewhere in a hollow log or under somebody's deck or somewhere, but they're going to lose their ears and the tips of their tails to frostbite, and that's the way it works out. But enough will get through. Yes, there's probably some suffering out there and some mortality, but that occurs every winter, and there's relatively little we can do about it.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. You can join in with your questions and comments. He's going to be with us right up till 12:30. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have some photos up there right now. We'll take a look at them after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. You know, we have a lot of great regular guests to come by to spend time and talk with us and share what they know. And I'll tell you what, there are only a few that have as much a following as Scott Craven, who's with me today. And we hear oftentimes from listeners like you who say they enjoy Scott talking about animal behavior. And certainly he's here today to do it again. Scott, as always, thanks for spending time with us today. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here, Larry, for a whole host of reasons.
Yes, for a whole host. Oh, well, I tell you what, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the news right now, and I know there's some events coming up, meetings and stuff that we probably ought to talk about a little bit before we, you know, time gets away from us.
All right. Well, here's a few things that are kind of in the news that are either points of interest or things coming up that people might want to get involved with. First of all, I thought it was kind of cool that the Wisconsin contingent of whooping cranes made it to Florida again, I think yesterday or the day before. It was the 13th annual migration. 8 cranes left Wisconsin in October, and they've been safely deposited at the St. Mark's Refuge in Florida for another year. So that was good. The annual Golden Eagle Survey is coming up on January 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose this is primarily over along the Mississippi River.
Right.
From La Crosse south. I mean, it was only just a few years ago that we realized that there were golden eagles there in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, most people, when somebody said, oh, I saw a golden eagle, oh, no, you didn't. That was just a juvenile bald eagle. But in fact, it was determined that the area along the Mississippi and those steep valleys heading back up into southwestern Wisconsin were a key wintering area for golden eagles. Last year's survey tallied 132, so it's not just a couple of birds. Anyway, that survey will be taking place again on January 18th. Also on that weekend, it's free fishing weekend.
Yeah.
They've extended that for the second year. There's usually one in June, I think. But in this case, it's a free fishing weekend, so folks can folks can go out and try ice fishing. Also, same time window, eagle watching days in Prairie du Sac and Sauk City. It should be fantastic. The cold and ice have really concentrated the eagles, and there are lots of them. Last year, record number of breeding pairs in Wisconsin, 1,343 pairs
Amazing.
Of eagles. Up from just back in the 70s when I got here, 100 or less.
Yeah.
So that's a big success story. And there's a link on the DNR website entitled Eagle Feature, which can link you to a variety of activities around the state that deal with eagle viewing. Also, I mentioned earlier that that the issue of hunting in state parks is coming up for permanent rules. And there are 4 meetings around the state from January 14th to the 23rd in Appleton, Eau Claire, Wausau, and Fitchburg. You can check the DNR website if you want to weigh in on that issue. Also, a couple of days ago, the latest map came out for where white nose syndrome has been identified as far as our bats are concerned. The good news is Wisconsin is still clear. The bad news is there was a confirmed white nose case in the extreme western part of Missouri, which is the westernmost discovery to date. And I can tell you, as you look at the map, Wisconsin is one of the dwindling number of blank spots on the map. So anyway, that's still good news on that front. Last couple of things, all of the changes in the deer hunting season framework that have been proposed as a result of the Deer Trustees Report will be going before the Natural Resources Board in February. There are going to be some major changes in the way the deer season is run, managed, and evaluated. Baiting and feeding somehow survived. I don't know how, but they did. And other big change, I guess, that was very contentious is that it is now, come next year, will be legal for anybody who wants to use one to use a crossbow during the archery season. So that's, at least in some people's minds, a big deal. We'll see whether it turns out to be or not. So that's kind of what's in the news and what's out there happening that people might want to get involved with.
Mary in Milwaukee has a question for you, Scott. Let's go to her. Mary, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Nope, no problem. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually have two questions. The first one is several years ago, and this occurred in Milwaukee at an apartment complex, I saw a mother and several baby birds that had very tall legs. I'm thinking the baby's legs were probably almost 3 inches tall. And they had this plume on top of their head that stuck up kind of like a pencil. I mean, multiple hairs kind of sticking up like a pencil and then turning over a little bit. Never, and I've looked in every bird book imaginable, and I cannot find anything that even comes close to identifying them. And the body on it was like a wren, brownish. They weren't very big. They were rather small.
In so much as it was near people, you mentioned an apartment complex. Yeah. I mean, the bird that comes to mind, if you want to look at your field guide, there are a couple of species of western quail that are kind of small, but their legs are fairly long. They do a lot of running around in the desert, and they have this beautiful little plume of feathers that kind of goes up and curls back down over their head. I was in Arizona in September, and there were a valley quail out running around all over the backyard of the house we were staying in. They were cute little things. But these are moved around.
The plumes was not feathers. It looked, it looked like it was almost plastic, if you could imagine that. Thin, tiny pieces of plastic, like thinner than like hair, that thin.
I have no idea. I can't even think of an exotic that might have been an escape that has that kind of.
So these thin little plastic like hairs or feathers or whatever they were not coalesced into some sort of a plume or a crest or something like that?
Well, I guess the best way to describe it, because I'm not sure doing a very good job, is there were lots of hairs that were sticking straight up and then would turn over a little bit.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is that for a number of nestling birds, when they first emerge from the nest, they may be very fuzzy looking and have all sorts of weird hair-like feathers sticking up. And if did you see what kind of a bill they had? I mean, there are a number of the different small herons, for example, that have lots of hair-like feathers on their heads, and the young look really weird and fuzzy when they're first out of the nest. And if this was somewhere near a river or pond or something, and family of green herons or who knows what was nesting in the apartment complex and they were marching off to the pond, that's a possibility. Did it have a big bill or a little tiny bill like a sparrow or something?
No. The body of the bird was kind of like a sparrow, and so was the bill, and the mother was about the same size, just a little bit bigger.
Well, this is where we, as on Do You Want to Be a Millionaire, we have to turn to our audience, our vast audience of skilled birders, and see if anything comes to mind here. But Larry and I are drawing
are
a
stumped.
Blank. How about maybe we can do better on question number two?
Okay. I would very much like to put some bat houses in my yard for mm-hmm. the summer to take care of the insects, but I'm concerned about rabies.
I wouldn't let that deter you from putting up bat houses. It's a, although it's a finite risk, it's a slim one, and if you're cautious about both you and any kids or whatever visiting or in the yard, that they're just cautioned that, hey, we've got a bat colony here. If you ever find a bat on the ground or flopping around or something like that, stay away from it, or find an adult. Then I think that that's manageable. But you know, there are. People have put up thousands, tens of thousands of bat houses. It's become the thing to do over the last couple of decades, and I've not had a single report where an issue with rabies was traced to a bat house, and in part because the bat that most commonly has the strain of rabies that gets involved with people, silver-haired bats, are not necessarily using bat houses, so... Yeah, the bottom line is find a good design for a bat house, build them yourselves, buy them commercially, erect them properly with the right exposure, height, and so forth, and enjoy the bats, derive whatever benefit you get out of their insect eating, but I don't think you need to lose sleep at night over the rabies potential or threat.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have, on my Facebook page, I hope you have a chance to go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, because our earlier caller, who had three... different birds of, like, partially albino. There's, and
there's
I, we
the
have
cardinal.
Them. And here's another shot.
There's the woodpecker.
A woodpecker there. And let's see. What's
there's
this?
The chickadee.
There's the chickadee. So.
Well, I'll be darned.
Three of them right in his yard. What a lucky guy and gal. Oh, so. Please go to my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you're going to see over on the right side. Click onto those, and you're going to see.
Now, if folks are viewing these, Larry, and they have some thoughts on what's going on, or they've seen something similar to that in the same species, they can comment back. And
yes,
is that okay?
Yeah, they can. Yeah, please, if you have anything to post, please go ahead and post, or even try to get in and call. Matt in Waukesha has a question for you, Scott. Matt, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I actually have a couple observations about red squirrels.
Uh-huh.
In this past bow season, I was in my my stand and looking around, and I looked behind me in the pine boughs were these round white objects. And as I'm looking at these or staring at dozens of these things, I realized that they were 2 to 3 inches in diameter. They were mushrooms.
Yep.
Turned upside down, just laying on these branches all over the place. Of course, the red squirrels are running up and down these same branches.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming that these squirrels were either drying them or I'm not really sure what they were doing with them, but these white mushrooms were everywhere. And the second observation I had was I was in another stand on my property, and I'm watching two deer come by, and they started digging at a mound from a blowdown. And as they're digging in the dirt, they're reaching down and eating something from the hole they just dug.
Mm-hmm.
A little while later, a red squirrel goes into that same hole and comes out with something that was the size of a ping pong ball, brown in color, and it runs up the tree that I'm sitting in and sits on a branch about a foot from my face, and he's got this thing in his mouth. And it's, like I said, it's about the size of a ping pong ball, and it's round and it's brown. And I'm thinking, is this like a truffle? Although when I asked the DNR in Wausau, I had talked to somebody up there about it, they didn't think truffles grew that far north. But just an observation. I
very interesting.
Quite understand. Do red squirrels eat mushrooms?
Yeah. Eat well, couple things, Matt. First thing I'd like to point out is that it's interesting just to hear you talk about these observations, because I think folks who don't hunt don't realize, for someone sitting in a tree stand or on a deer stand for hours and hours, you know, you might spend about 4 seconds actually seeing a deer and ultimately maybe even harvesting it. But for all the rest of those hours, you're kind of left to ponder the meaning of life and to observe all of the cool stuff that's going on in the woods that most people who are not hunting, me included, don't have the patience to just go out and sit there in a tree with the idea of, I wonder what I'm going to see. Now, photographers and some other folks do, but for the most part, that's one of the real important side benefits of spending time in the woods, hunting or otherwise. Now, back to the red squirrels. First of all, they're notorious for eating lots of fungi, mushrooms of all sorts. And they're also notorious for caching. So it doesn't surprise me that they might, I've never heard of them hauling them up in the tree like that, but they'll go up in the trees and cut the tips off pine boughs to get cones and whatnot, and the reverse of putting those mushrooms up there where they feel they might be safe. I'm not sure about the drying issue, but caching them where they feel they can get them or remove them from the competition of other things that might be eating them is within the realm of possibility. But they do eat a lot of mushrooms. What you probably saw the deer digging up was a red squirrel cache, and there could have been just about anything in there, from mushrooms to pine seeds to stuff from some neighbor's bird feeder to who knows what. Whatever the deer were interested in, they were eating. Whatever the squirrel decided, hey, I got to get that out of there because I really want it. I suppose round and brown, it could have been a puffball. It could have been a rhizome from some sort of a plant that it had dug up. It might have been you got a good look at it. It probably wasn't a black walnut or something like that was round. But whatever it was, I don't know. But the squirrel obviously decided it wanted to save it and eat it itself. So, but what you were seeing was two common behaviors of red squirrels. One is caching food in large mounds or piles, and the other is eating mushrooms.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Matt, appreciate your call. Oh, good calls today we're getting. Owen emailed us and lives between Herbster and Cornucopia. He said, if there was a cougar attack in our area, I would have heard about it. He's not so sure about it.
Well, I don't know what we can do about that. But
we'll look into it.
We'll look into it, but if people right there haven't heard about it, I'm not so sure what happened.
We had a comment from Peter. I said it was a good one. You're not an entomologist, but you know a lot about bugs. I think one good thing about this cold spell is that the bugs we complain about, especially like the emerald ash borer, do not like this cold weather. And so I think may well have knocked back the emerald ash borer population. It'd be good to know.
It seems like there's been some talk about that. Yeah. Next time Phil's on, he's going to comment on it. But I'm guessing a lot of egg masses have not been able to tolerate this brutal cold. And without really deep snow cover, the birds that forage on egg masses, like the chickadees and whatnot, are with short food and needing food badly. Not only are the egg masses going to be taken out by the cold, but they're going to be hit heavily by predation. So if that's a good spinoff of the Arctic vortex, then so be it.
Oh, man. Bird wondered, what keeps squirrel nests from blowing out of trees? Man, they're stuck in there pretty darn good.
They're pretty adept at, if he's thinking about these big leaf nests that they build in a crotch.
They are in there.
They're in there tight. The squirrels weave them into the twigs and whatnot, and I suppose they may lose a leaf or two, but they can rebuild them too. And those are not their main nests. They're in a hollow tree somewhere this time of year. Those are largely for escape purposes, and if one does blow out, they'll build another one. So no sweat.
Drew in Brooklyn, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Yes, hello, Larry. You know, Scott, I'm one of those big fans when you come on. My exposure to early wildlife in Wisconsin was through a book called Mammals of Wisconsin.
By Hartley Jackson.
Published by the Wisconsin University Press, and it was in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw about a month or so ago, after the first snow, a rodent coming popping up the way voles and shrews, and they pop up out of the snow, they go back underneath, and I saw what looked like a mouse, mostly white, with brown spots. And I did not recognize that as a native species. So I was asked to.
Yeah.
You know, it was a mouse shape, but it might have had more I don't know, maybe a rat-like, small rat head, a little bit elongated neck, more than a mouse. And I'm wondering, my thought was perhaps this was a domestic pet and was released or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple possibilities. And first of all, if you're still working with Hartley Jackson's 1959 book, there have been a couple that have come out since that are kind of modernized upgrades and have some color photographs. Stan Tequila has a little more field guide-like book on mammals of Wisconsin. Charlie Long up at UW Stevens Point published Wild Mammals of Wisconsin 5 or 6 years ago. And a really nice book on tracks and sign and mammals is Mark Elbrock's Mammal Tracks and Sign. So there are some other good books out there. One possibility, small, skinny animal popping up out of the snow that looks kind of spotted could have been a least weasel in the transition from brown coat to white coat.
Yeah.
There is no native rodent, or for that matter, mammal of any kind that's truly spotted. But a couple of our smaller weasels, particularly the least weasel, which is no bigger than a good fat cigar, and seeing the front end of it could certainly be taken as a mouse or rodent of some kind because of the size. If that animal was making the transition and kind of caught halfway, depending on the timing, that's one possibility. Otherwise, we fall back to the kind of thing that's going on with these birds we've been talking about, where maybe it was a white-footed mouse or deer mouse that for whatever reason had been injured or had mange or whatever and gave that spotted appearance. But beyond that, no native spotted mammal.
There you go. Thanks a lot. CWD management, because we're just about out of time here, Scott, in 30 seconds, any comments on the management?
It came home to roost last Thursday. My son came home for deer season. I, of course, couldn't hunt. He shot a nice buck, and we got the call last Thursday that it was CWD positive. It's the fifth positive that either my son or I are shot, so out the deer goes, so no venison this year. It's still around. The incidence is, or the prevalence is increasing. The spread is increasing, albeit slowly. It's dropped off a lot of folks' radar screens, and I think that's unfortunate because it doesn't seem to be going anywhere, and it's not a problem that's going to take care of itself.
Scott, it's always a pleasure. We'll look for you first Wednesday of February.
February,
all
yes.
Right. That'll be good. Scott Graven, wildlife ecologist. It's great to have him back, and he will be back the first Wednesday in February. In the meantime, hey, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.